This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Kalamazoo College graduate Bronte Payne discusses her work with Environment America, urging college campuses to use renewable sources of energy. But first, Bridge has named 54 high schools in the state as academic state champs. They include both of Kalamazoo's high schools, Lloyd Norricks and Kalamazoo Central, as well as South Haven and Vicksburg high schools. And the online news service for the Center for Michigan also examined why some students from some high schools are better prepared for college or the workplace. Mike Wilkinson is Bridge's computer reporting specialist. He joins us via Skype. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
First of all, give us the methodology, Mike, for how you come up with academic state champs.
Well, in the past, what we have done is we've looked at test scores during their careers, during from third grade to 11th grade. And that's not possible anymore because the state has changed the methodology. We've switched from the MEEP tests to the MSTEP. We switched from the ACT to the SAT. And so we no longer have three consecutive years of comparable data. So what we did this year is we decided to look what happens after high school, or for the most part, what happens after high school, to kind of get an impression of how schools are preparing kids for the workplace or for college. And so what we did is we looked at measures that are out there now that track based on where a student graduated. Did they enroll in college? Did they enroll in a certificate program? Did they enroll in a university? And then 4 years later, we looked at do they have a degree? Do they have a certificate? Or are they still in college? And we combined that with a measure during their school year, their school career, and how well they were prepared as juniors in high school. And we put that together and looked, and we're kind of calling it, what schools are best preparing kids for life after high school, be it university college setting or for the workplace.
And you have these broken down by the poverty rate for the students in these schools. Why is it important to break it down that way?
Well, a number of studies have shown that, unfortunately, family income is a all too accurate predictor of academic success. Students who come from homes with higher incomes, their parents typically are more educated, so they're around a richer environment at times at the home. They have more opportunities during the summer, so they don't have the bleed off of what they've learned in the previous year. They have enrichment vacations. They get extra tutoring. They go to museums, and students from lower incomes have a lot of other hurdles that they face. They face in many cases hunger, and in fact we measure family income by the percentage of students within a school that are eligible for a free or reduced priced lunch. I mean, there's all sorts of hurdles that occur in the home of a poor child, and it's not just hunger. They don't have the same access to role models and mentors typically. They don't have the enrichment opportunities. Perhaps they don't have as good of the single parent, so there's not as much attention to helping them keep up with their schoolwork. So what we do is, rather than compare Detroit to Birmingham or Detroit to Portage, Kalamazoo to Portage, we put them in different income groups. And then that way you're only comparing East Grand Rapids and Forest Hills together, or with Okemos. You're comparing Kalamazoo schools with the Saginaw schools and the Detroit schools. So that way you're getting it's not a perfect comparison, but it's better than just saying, my school is so much better than your school. Well, in many cases, the school with less poverty should be doing well because they have fewer hurdles. Their students have fewer hurdles.
And the companion article that you have along with the academic state champ story is six reasons why students at some high schools are better prepared for college or career. And number one is money matters. Can you give us, though, maybe a little bit more of a breakdown here? How much does money matter?
Well, let's look at some of the measures that we looked at for this particular package. I mean, we looked at college enrollment and college progression. So, kids who one got in, and then secondly were able to sustain their careers either to the point where they got a degree or certificate. In a wealthy family, and the number one school in the state was Troy High School. It has the second lowest poverty rate in the state. The school that had the highest was number two in the state in terms of success. Those kids have an opportunity to go to schools. They might not have to work as much when they're in school, so they're going to be able to focus. They might are more likely to have two role model parents who perhaps have a college degree. They might have grandparents that have college degrees. So that you have a culture of college success that just doesn't exist In many cases, unfortunately, for those of lesser means, and at times, even with my own children who go to college, when they stumble upon a problem in the college setting, I know what the bursar's office is, I know what the treasurer's office is, I'm familiar with that whole process, I'm able to help them. And kids who are first generation college kids, which is the case in many and often with the poorer students, they can't lean immediately on their parents or those around them. And that's one thing we pointed out is that's been identified by a number of people where universities and colleges can help. Is providing that support that perhaps their own families and friend network can't. You have campus coaches, at Western Michigan, Wayne State, where they're providing that role where they're helping people navigate the college experience. You probably went to college. The course catalog and course schedule can be kind of daunting, and then you miss. A payment on a chemistry beaker that you broke, and suddenly you're staring at a $200 bill, and you can't register the next semester. Well, you can get frustrated if you don't have anyone to help you get through that. And so those are kind of the hurdles that people of lesser means might have that those who have higher means don't have.
And you do note that what happens after high school, at least for students going on to college here, is important. Is there an argument to be made based on what you're reporting here that colleges and universities should be trying to bolster the support that they give to students who perhaps come to campus not quite at the same level as other students in terms of being prepared for college?
Well, absolutely. I mean, and it's been recognized by the group that is kind of the unifying association of the 15 public universities. The privates have all recognized it as well. I mean, Michigan is in a position with its education levels that it matches now where our per capita income is. Before, because of the high wage, low skill jobs that we had in the state, we were 16th in the nation in terms of wages, but we were like 30th in terms of our education levels. Well, now we're both at 30th for income and education. And everyone says we need to become a state that has more educated people. And getting a higher percentage of those kids of means into college, there's just not enough of them. Demographically, there's fewer and fewer kids every year. If we're going to increase the pool of people who have a degree, who are succeeding through higher education, the greatest opportunity is to help those who need the help. Helping someone who comes from a home of 100 grand is not, there's just not enough of those kids, and they're already going to college. We need to help those kids who come from not just low income, but lower income families, because then we can kind of move the state up in terms of the ranking and in terms of where we are with as a percentage of our adult population that has a college education.
You also say that there really is a need for more college counseling. This would be at the high school level. Where is Michigan falling short there?
There's been legislation proposed for a number of years to have every high school counselor have the additional education and skill set to help kids get into college. That's one, and that has not passed. I mean, a lot of the schools, the wealthy schools, have dedicated counselors who, just put out applications, know all the schools, can know the names of the financial aid people at all the campuses, and have an idea of what the environment is, so they can help the kids fit. But in many cases, in Michigan, we have a ratio of students to counselor that is, statewide it's 700. The national average is 400. Even if they had the skills, they're overworked. And then if you go into some of the lower income schools, they're dealing with very real issues in terms of discipline, in terms of behavior, helping kids, navigate, the toxins of poverty, for lack of a better phrase, that they don't have as much time. So what the Michigan College Access Network has done, and others, is they're funding, they're training existing counselors, they're funding counselors to solely go into schools and help those kids, and it's providing this wonderful opportunity, in Muskegon and Melvindale, in Huron County and Michigan's Thumb, where it's giving those kids in those high schools the same level of college counseling that you would find, at Birmingham, a Bloomfield, I don't know. I think Portage is a fairly wealthy area around you. Those exist in those places, but they don't necessarily exist in the rural areas and in the poor areas.
So both of the Kalamazoo high schools, Loy Norris and Kalamazoo Central, are in the lowest income high schools, but yet making this list. How much of a straight line can we draw between the Kalamazoo schools doing well and the Kalamazoo Promise?
Well, it's really interesting. I was kind of excited to see that they were there, because where they really excelled was in that enrollment and in college and progress, which is, you know, getting kids to enroll in an institution, and then 4 years later, making sure a higher percentage of them are either still in or have a degree or certificate. And in both cases, they were in the top quartile among those schools. And I think when you look at what has happened with the promise, with the guarantee of tuition, you know, it's kind of, you know, the results seem to speak that it is working. I mean, that these kids are taking advantage of it. Now, you still have the problem, you know, if this group, if Lloyd Norris and Kalamazoo Central were in a higher income group, they wouldn't be in the top. But that's not who we're comparing them to. We're comparing them to like schools, and they did very well. You know, they are getting those kids in school, and they're staying. And I guess, you know, when someone else is paying the bill, or at least, you know, the tuition part of it, that's fantastic news, and it's great for the community, and it's great for the students.
There has been an effort in several other cities, some of them in Michigan, to try and develop some sort of a promise-like program. Does what you're showing here in these results indicate that that's something that people should be pursuing, that there is a real payoff to it if you, especially if you have a school district which has demographics similar to Kalamazoo, or maybe not even quite as good as Kalamazoo's?
Well, I mean, obviously, the results in Kalamazoo speak for themselves, and there was a study, you know, by the Upjohn Institute that showed that there was some real value to what the promise has brought. Like you mentioned, there are a number of around the state, none as lucrative for the student as the promise. I mean, you're getting thousands of dollars per year. You're not getting that, you know, free tuition whether you go to Michigan or whether you go to Central Michigan. I think more study has to be done. I mean, are the kids that are really succeeding at Kalamazoo the poorest of those kids? I mean, we know that the free and reduced lunch number, I don't have the number in front of me, is in the 60%. Are those the kids that are going through it, or is it the 40% of the kids who came to Kalamazoo because of the promise? I don't know. More study, but it, obviously on the surface, it looks like it absolutely is working, and that it is bringing a benefit to the community.
One of the other things you note about the schools where there does seem to be some good numbers is magnet schools. What do these offer that maybe sort of the traditional school setting does not?
This has happened in a number of cases when our previous academic state champs, these schools have jumped out at us repeatedly. I think when you have a magnet school, you're already indicating parental motivation and student motivation. So you're attracting a different student than, you know, in many cases you have to drive farther, or the mom and dad have to drive farther. You got to get on a bus. So you're already indicating to, you know, everybody that you value education. I mean, you got the school in Saginaw. Saginaw schools have a very high poverty level. You know, but the Arts and Sciences Academy there has a poverty level that's half of what the rest of the school district is. So these kids are a little wealthier. They're choosing something that is a little more rigorous. And that bodes well for, one, their readiness when they're coming out of high school, and then with the success they're going to enjoy post high school. You know, the two magnet schools in Detroit, Cass Tech and Renaissance, do fantastic. The, you know, Saginaw, I mentioned, there's one in Grand Rapids City Middle. I mean, these are schools that, in any income group, they would be among the best. I mean, you have the International Academy in Bloomfield, which isn't in our list, but it's a big magnet school. It's off the charts in terms of the quality of the students that it's producing.
Are magnet schools attracting a diverse group? Do we see that in terms of, you know, in race and income and that sort of thing? Is it getting a big mix, or is there a certain thread that kind of runs through the people who are likely to go to magnet schools?
Well, it depends on the district. I mean, you look at Detroit, a district that is, you know, 82% African American. You know, Cass Tech and Renaissance are the magnet schools, and I'm pretty sure they're 82 or 85% African American. So they're just as, well, I guess that's not diverse when you're in those percentages, but In Saginaw, it is not as diverse as Arthur Hill and the other high school, but they're not like a suburban Macomb County school, or, you know, suburban Kalamazoo area school. I mean, they are still attracting, minorities and children of lesser means. But yeah, they aren't as diverse as the districts in which they exist, except I think in the case of Detroit, the City Middle in Grand Rapids. I mean, it's diverse. I mean, it's just got a different. I mean, that school district, you have school districts that are heavily Hispanic. You have school districts. Schools that are heavily African American, and some in the middle. City Middle High School, City Middle High, which has a very odd name, is diverse, but it is not. It is very different than the rest of the district.
So in this article about six reasons why students at some high schools are better prepared for college or career, you also note that there are many paths to success. And you note here, Battle Creek Central High School, nearly 11% of grads got a two-year degree or a certificate, and nearby Homer Community High School, nearly 17% did. We've spent a lot of time here talking about going on to college, but is there also another component here that we should be looking at, which is, are students able to go on, get a certificate, maybe not necessarily get a four-year college degree, but they are prepared to go and earn a good living?
That's a conversation that's been taking place in the state for a while, and it needs to continue. There's a lot of skilled jobs that do not need a full four-year liberal arts, engineering degree. You can become a welder. You can become a different levels of nursing, and those bring good money. I mean, you have apprentice programs. Become a mason or a carpenter. I think one thing that you would have with increased college counseling is I think you would have more people suggesting these options to kids. You have vocational schools out there that are generating people that can weld, who are walking, 19, 20 years old, are going out and making $13, $14, $15 an hour. Is it $40 an hour? No, but it's a decent chunk of change, and it's going to grow. So you have these opportunities that are around, there are many paths. I mean, you have Battle Creek Central. I mean, you have 11% of the kids who are getting a certificate. The amount of money that you're going to make in your lifetime is going to increase with every additional amount of education you can get, from high school dropout to a high school graduate, are hundreds of thousands of dollars. From high school graduate to someone with a certificate is a couple hundred thousand dollars, and it just keeps going, to the point where you're talking, millions of dollars potentially if you get a doctorate. So, yes, there are many paths. Not everybody has to go to Michigan Tech and become a mechanical engineer. Maybe they can become a draftsman or a cosmetologist. That will still set them up better than if they stop their education the day they graduate from high school.
But you also tell us here at the end of the story that Bridges' analysis showed that a number of high schools are generating too many grads who aren't getting post-secondary degrees, in part because they simply weren't ready for the demands of higher education. If somebody who is in the mix of public policy is reading that, what are the things they should be thinking about that might move the needle more in the direction we'd like to see it go?
Well, this is something that the state kind of revealed a couple years ago, where they compared. It was kind of an uproar at the time that these graduation rates were so high in some of these schools, and then the kids weren't ready for college. But then there was a second piece that the high remediation rates, and remedial is you go to college and you decide that you want to take a math class, and you take the placement test, and they find out you need to take basically high school level math. And the problem is you end up spending college level money for credits that don't go towards the degree. We have many kids in the state, that I think in some high schools that are, 50, 60% of the kids get to college. They need to retake English. They need to retake some science classes. They need to retake math is the biggest one. And yet 78, 90% of the kids are graduating from these high schools. So there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect. They're graduating, but they're not prepared to do post-secondary work. You've got to do math if you're a welder. If you're working as a tool and guide guy, you've got to be able to do some of these skills. And I think the public policy angle is, what is a degree? What is a diploma? And is there some baseline level of knowledge that you must have? And I don't know. It's a vexing issue because, a lot of times, do you want to have kids that are in there 19, 20, 21 years old still in high school who haven't graduated? It's a difficult question.
Mike Wilkinson, thank you very much for your time.
I appreciate your interest.
Mike Wilkinson is computer-assisted reporting specialist for Bridge. He joined us via Skype. Stories about the 2017 Academic State Champs and the reasons why students from some high schools are more prepared for college and work are at bridgemi.com. Links are also available at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Getting colleges and universities to reduce their carbon footprint and eventually get all of their power from renewable sources is one of the goals of the group Environment America. One of the people who works for Environment America is a Kalamazoo College graduate. Bronte Payne is their clean energy associate. Thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So explain for our audience what it is that Environment America does.
So Environment America is a federation of state-based citizen-funded environmental advocacy groups with 29 state-based groups across the country and staff in D.C., and we work to protect clean air and clean water and open spaces for citizens across the country.
And what would you say your typical day or week looks like working for them?
My typical week, so I work on two of our campaigns on the renewable energy side. I work to advance offshore wind along the Atlantic coast, as well as move colleges and universities to 100% renewable energy, as you said. So my typical week involves working with coalition partners, working with our staff across the country, to advance offshore wind, and working to get governors to make commitment to large-scale and long-term offshore wind for their states. And on the campus side, it's really working with our staff across the country and working with students to think of how they can engage their campus and engage their administrations to make these big, bold commitments to 100% renewable energy.
Do colleges and universities or the administrators of those colleges and universities that you talk to seem like they do want to accomplish this goal of having all of their energy come from renewable sources by 2050?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, of course, for the administrators, there's a lot of factors that goes into making a commitment like this. But by and large, I think the higher education sector thinks that now more than ever, they really have an opportunity to lead the country on making this transition to 100% renewable energy. We know that it's a big, bold goal, but also a completely necessary vision if we want to stop global warming and create a more livable future for kids that are growing up today and the same kids that are attending these universities.
Is 2050 a realistic timetable to get that done?
Absolutely. A lot of colleges and universities have commitments to reduce their carbon footprint already. And we've seen even entire states starting to make different commitments to reducing their carbon footprint. And our plan lays it out so that a school would achieve 100% renewable electricity by 2030, and then to achieve 100% renewable energy by 2050, you would be transferring things like your campus transportation and making that electrified and adding that to your clean grid, and then moving your heating and cooling to being more electric and more renewable heavy to achieve that. But there have been a whole host of studies done all across the country saying how different states could achieve 100% renewable energy by 2050. So I think it's absolutely possible that campuses could achieve that as well.
Is there some incentive for college campuses to do this from a bottom line standpoint that it is maybe with a short-term investment in the long run more cost-effective?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a lot of studies out there that have shown campuses can save a lot of money in the long term by committing to renewable energy and really scaling up their use of both renewable energy and energy efficiency. So they're greatly reducing their energy use overall. But we've also seen that students are starting to care a lot more about how green their campuses are. So in the admissions process, students are increasingly looking at how much renewable energy a campus is using, how committed they are to tackling climate change, and it's influencing the way that students pick which colleges they're going to go to. So I think it also helps their energy savings, of course, but then also the kind of students that they're bringing into their campuses.
As you go and talk to people at colleges and universities, do you find that there's a big range of how far down the road they are right now? I mean, here at Western Michigan University, there are solar panels set up. There are charging stations for electric cars. So do you find some colleges and universities that maybe haven't taken those steps yet and maybe some others which have gone beyond that?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a pretty wide range of how far campuses are in transitioning to renewable energy. A campus like Western Michigan is a leader across the country when it comes to increasing energy efficiency and really increasing the renewable energy that they have on campus. But other colleges have done a lot less. But we still think that all of these campuses can set these bold goals to achieve 100% renewable energy. And it's going to be really important moving forward because colleges are pretty large energy users. So when they commit to these goals, it can make a really big difference in their community in reducing the energy that's used. But also by engaging students in these campaigns to get their campuses committed to 100% renewable energy, we have the ability to be training the civic leaders and the researchers of the future to engage in making their campus, their community at large, and eventually the country more sustainable. And the last thing is that colleges and universities are really invaluable research hubs that will be conducting a lot of the research that's going to help us overcome some of these remaining challenges that we have to shifting to 100% renewable energy. And then making these commitments, whether you are already pretty far down the line or just getting started, it can spur that research by your students and by your faculty on the campus. That's going to help the whole country make a transition at some point.
How did your experience as a student at K College lead you into this field? What were some of the experiences you had at K that kind of informed what you've done in your professional life?
Yeah, I think my experience at K was really invaluable to what I do now. When I first arrived on campus in 2011, I was planning to be a doctor at some point. But for me, my interest in environmental problems really got started by learning about and seeing the repercussions of the Enbridge oil spill in the Kalamazoo River. It's pretty shocking to me that things like that happen and we don't really hold anyone accountable for them. And my interest then in sort of campus sustainability really began to grow as I got more involved in organizing on campus. And then in my senior year, I was a student sitting on the planning committee for the new Fitness and Wellness Center on K's campus. And found out that they were perhaps thinking about not making it quite as energy efficient as we thought the building could be moving forward as a new building. So we were able to really engage the student body to call on the administration to recertify the building. And I think because we had a bold goal for carbon neutrality and we had a climate action plan on campus, we were able to then work with the administration to come up with a solution. And instead of paying to have the building recertified, they were actually able to choose two students on campus who became student auditors of the project and got to see the oversee the construction of the project and make recommendations. And I think for me, seeing how these bold climate goals can really spur student engagement, and then we can think creatively to continue to engage students to help make a campus more sustainable, was one of the things that really led me to then look for a job working on environmental problems and working for environmental solutions moving forward. And I was really lucky to find a job right out of K with Environment America.
Bronte Payne, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Have a great rest of your day.
Bronte Payne is Clean Energy Associate for Environment America. She's also a Kalamazoo College graduate. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.